Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Sabbe sankhara anicca, sabbe sankhara dukkha, sabbe dhamma anatta iti. Which, hopefully, that many people living in this monastery who've got at least a little bit of understanding about Pali, if you don't even know Pali, you should recognize that gata at the beginning, that all compounded things are impermanent, or unstable, uncertain, that they're also dukkha, and that all dhammas are empty of any essence of self. But in particular, that we're starting this range retreat here in this monastery, and this year we have some of the sisters who are coming on Wednesday night to listen to the Dhamma. And it's very important to keep the Dhamma very simple but very profound. Sometimes, especially for Westerners, if we make it too complicated, we end up thinking too much, and we think too much already. And thinking has caused you enough suffering already in your life. You don't want to encourage too much thinking to create even more suffering. So we want to keep it simple. And sometimes that the whole ethos of a forest monastery is keeping things simple. Just the way that we have this hall here with very few furnishings, keeping it simple. Keeping the monastic lifestyle simple, wearing simple robes, you know, doing things simply. That simplicity just goes against the realm of complexity, which makes life just so complex and hard to understand. So we have to keep it simple, whether it's our meditation or our understanding of Dhamma. Simple is profound. Sometimes people misunderstood complexity as profundity. In other words, if you can't understand it, it must be deep. That sort of stupidity I rebelled against when I was a young monk, even before I was a young monk, even as a lay Buddhist. And I still remember just one of the quotes from my science days, Werner Heisenberg, one of the great founders of quantum science, quantum physics, quantum mechanics, which many people think is incomprehensible. But he said, if you can't explain quantum physics to the girl serving your beer behind the bar, you don't understand what you're talking about. In other words, she should be able to understand it if you know what you're talking about. And that was a powerful statement by somebody who did know what they were talking about. They were part of the pioneer group of quantum science. So if you are a Buddhist monk or a nun and you know what you're talking about, people should be able to understand it simply, profoundly and deeply. So this is my task, to take this Dhamma of the Buddha, to know it, and then to present it in a way that you can understand, but which is not superficial, which goes to the very heart of things. And you can't get a deeper Dhamma or a more profound Dhamma than the teaching of Dhammacakka, which we just chanted. That is a powerful sermon. And sometimes, because on the surface it looks easy to understand, that people just pass it by and they look for something a bit more complex, so they can exercise their thinking on it. But instead we should just pause and just look at this simple sutta, these great teachings of the Buddha, which created the first stream winners. And there was Anya Kondanya, who listened to that for the first time and got it, and was a stream winner, told by the Buddha, yes, you have seen, you have understood, Kondanya. And what did he really understand? This simple teaching, sabbe sankhara dukkha. It's important to understand this, because without understanding the suffering and the extent of that suffering, just how dukkha permeates everything, you'll find that your meditation won't take off. Sometimes people think that they can separate meditation out from the Dhamma or from precepts. And, you know, that's a stupidity, a delusion, especially of Westerners. So you can just meditate, and after meditating you go to the pub, and then you can have sex with your girlfriend, and thinking you can get somewhere. And that, even Ajahn Chah, I remember him being asked once by this Westerner, of course, who said that he's still having sex, but he's not attached to it. And Ajahn Chah, he just laughed. He said, that's when he said, it's, oh yeah, okay, it's like having salt which isn't salty. And sayings like that from a great teacher would just really put down some of these delusions which people have. But why do people actually say such things? And it's because they don't see the whole depth of dukkha. They don't see just how this path all fits together as a whole. And when one part is missing, the other parts don't work. In this particular case, because this is a forest monastery and rains retreat, we focus on meditation, really getting the meditation together, making peace, developing stillness, getting into these deep joyful states of mind. And I don't mind keeping on pushing this point because this is the heart of the path. We're meditating monks. That's what's expected of us, that's why we're here, to end suffering. Or as they say in the suttas, sabbe sankhara samatha, to quiet and settle, to samatha, to settle all the sankharas, which is what you do in meditation. You're settling everything down. But you won't be able to do that unless you keep a very, very strong sila and virtue. The virtue of harmlessness and harmony and making peace, being gentle, being kind. So those of you who really want to gain success in this meditation in the next 3 months, watch your actions and especially your speech. Make sure that what comes out of your mouth, as the Buddha said, is right speech, which is gentle to the ear, kind, peaceful, warm. So the nice speech, the kind speech, the soft speech. And it's not anyone's job in this monastery to bawl anybody out, to shout at people or order them around. If you try doing things like that, your meditation becomes stuffed. It won't work. Simply because the ground, the foundation, hasn't been done. This was what I was talking about last week in the talk. To make sure your foundation of right speech and right action is good. And that's something you should train on. If you wanted to get deep meditation, you have to have that soft voice, that kindness, those gentle actions, the helping, the kind actions. I was talking to the sisters during this retreat. You've all got jobs to do. Some of you will forget to do those jobs, but it doesn't matter. If you see a job which needs to be done, then your attitude should never be, oh, it's not my job, it's not my duty, it's somebody else's. One's attitude in the monasteries is a wonderful opportunity to make good karma, to look after, to serve, so you do these things with happiness. It's our monastery. It's our place. So we help out with this idea that this is an opportunity to make good karma. I do remember when I went to Wat Pa Phong the first year, I had this Western attitude. We should have a roster and everyone should do their job and no one else should do the job if they're not rostered. And the Thais thought I was absolutely stupid, and I couldn't understand it at first until I really got to understand the idea of karma and its place in the scheme of things. To be able to do good things, to serve, is a way of letting go of desires and personal preferences. It's a way of developing this idea of service to the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. This idea of like giving, which is an important way of overcoming craving and attachments. So we give, but we give with joy. So we get off on just doing extra things for people. And I still remember the times I remember from my time in as a young monk were the times when I served and helped others. The story which comes to mind was Ajahn Manindo, when we were young monks in Wat Nanachat. And we were just talking one evening, and he said, oh, how hard it is to get up in the morning. You just got to get up and you've got to sit sort of in your hut, and it's haven't had enough sleep, and it's a hard floor, and it's really hot, and you're tired. And I said, just as a joke, I said, oh, I'll get you a cup of tea in bed in the morning for you. And he said, okay. And so I did it. And remember, I used to get up at 3 o'clock when the bell went, so I got up at 2:30. And I found some tea and made him a cup of tea. And I got to his hut at 3 o'clock in the morning and woke him up and said, here's your cup of tea. Actually, it was interesting I came at that particular time because the cup of tea never woke him up. Because as I actually knocked on the door, I saw a snake crawling under the door into his room. And it was a real snake, a banded crate. They're actually very, very venomous, but they usually don't bite anybody. And so I said, Ajamaninda, Ajamaninda, here's a cup of tea, and by the way, there's a snake coming under your door right now. He soon got up. He was very awake that morning, doubly awake. But anyhow, those little acts of service, I didn't need to do this, but I love doing it. And that sort of attitude, that's where I get good meditation. You know, if somebody asks for a favor, I do it for them. You know, as much as I could. You know how hard I work, because I like to be kind and be compassionate, but that's also why I get good meditation. It's the attitude of kindness and gentleness. It gets your sila right. But also, you need the motivation. The motivation to meditate. Why sit down there and just watch your breath for a couple of hours? Why do that? Why not just hang out and read a book, or listen to a radio, or just go and have a chat with someone, or just go and sleep and fantasize? The reason why is just what we just charted now. Just understanding just what the problem of life is. These four noble truths. Especially the problem of like suffering of life. Even in a community, you don't get what you want. Even just no matter how well we organize any monastery, it always sucks. It's never perfect. Sometimes it's perfect. Sometimes it's good. But a lot of times it's not. If you've got a perfect monastery, sometimes your body's not perfect. This is a time when you just have your opportunity to have a retreat, you go and get a cold, or you get a bung knee, or your back is out, or something happens. And you find that this is nothing wrong with samsara. Anyone who complains about this person giving you a hard time, or your knee giving you a hard time, or it being too hot or too cold, you're missing the point. As Ajahn Chah famously said, it's not the sound disturbs you, it's you who disturb the sound. It's not samsara disturbs you, it's you who disturb samsara. It's the nature of this body, it's the nature of the world, it's even the nature of this mind to be suffering, to be dukkha. Now our problem is that we always assume there can be some place, somewhere in this universe, somewhere in this world, where we can escape from suffering. And if you think you can come to this monastery and escape from suffering, you've missed the point. You come to a monastery on a retreat, not to escape from suffering, but to understand suffering. And then to become free from suffering. Free especially from the mental part of suffering. Which the Buddha used to call the two arrows, the mental arrow and the physical arrow. The physical arrow of suffering is part of having a body and a mind, getting what we don't want, having to struggle with things. But it's the mental arrow of suffering is what we can do something about. And this is actually our practice, to understand the mental arrow of suffering, how we react to the difficulties which we experience in life. The way we react is very much to do just with what we expect. And sometimes we just expect too much. You know, we expect too much from each other, we expect sometimes too much even from ourselves. And as a wise person, we should somehow or other just ask ourselves, whenever we have suffering, what do you expect? Sometimes that I did that when I was meditating, when I was living in monasteries, traveling or whatever. What do I expect from airlines? I expect them not to leave on time. I expect economy class to be uncomfortable. I expect people to ask me stupid questions. I expect Carlos to ring me up at all sorts of stupid times. Because people are like that. So you should expect by now me to hang up, I've done it enough times. But a lot of times, you understand where your suffering comes when we expect what life can't give us. That was my definition of suffering when somebody asked me, just, you know what, people are like, a Singaporean was very in a hurry and asked me, he said, "What suffering? Quick, I've got to go." And I just told him that suffering is expecting from this world what it can never give you. I like that little explanation. Expecting from this world what it will never give you. So when you understand this, and you've got something to work with, something simple, expecting what this world can't give you, then you ask yourself, what do I expect from my body? Can it give me that? Can it give me an hour or 2 hours without any aches or pains so I can sit and meditate, watch my breath? And the answer is usually no. Can it give me relief from cold and heat? The answer is no. Can it give me like freedom from indigestion every day? Usually no. So these are things, can it give me freedom from sickness, like not having a cold? Answer is no. Suffering is when you ask for things which you will never be able to get. So when you do have a bung knee, when you do have a bad back, when you do have a cold, make peace with it. Accept it, be kind to it, embrace it, understand it. It's a teacher for us, a teacher which shows us what this world really is like and what it can give us. It's the same as the world outside, your family, the water tanks, the nuns, the retreat center, the nuns' monastery, whatever it is which you're doing. Just the world doesn't work according to plans. I don't expect the retreat center to be perfect. I expect there to be hold-ups, to be difficulties. It's par for the course. I expect it to be much more than we've raised money for, because it's always that way, we're always overrun. But that's par for the course. I expect that. You can see when you expect these things, where is the suffering? When you expect these things, you get the physical suffering, but you've taken out the mental suffering. However, that's only a part of suffering. That's why I gave that explanation to the layperson. Suffering is asking from this world what it can never give you. And of course, you know there's much more to suffering than that. Just letting go is not enough. We have to go far deeper. And the deeper is, it's just, even if you just let go of just wanting things, just life still sucks. Just having a body, experiencing it, having to meditate, even getting jhanas, sucks. In other words, it's just, you get the jhana but it doesn't last. You get sort of deep experiences and it goes away again. And so you ask yourself, why? What am I doing? What's this all about? And hopefully, you get the message that sabbe sankhara dukkha, that all compounded things suck, are suffering. Not just having a body, but having a mind sucks. In other words, just feeling. Having senses is suffering. Just having to read, looking, hearing, smelling, tasting, having this irritating body, which the Buddha compared to as a cow whose skin has been taken off at the crossroads, but still alive and having flies on this bare flesh. And if you think that that's a pretty sort of graphic idea of irritation. And that's what this physical body is like. It's always irritating us. Sometimes you just coughed. Why did you cough? It's irritating. You're going to cough again in a few minutes. You're sort of itchy. You've got aches. Don't you think, probably no one in this room here hasn't got an ache or an irritation somewhere in this body. This is why we see this body is suffering. And just to listen to people. You know, sometimes I have to develop a lot of compassion and kindness, listening to people sometimes all day. sometimes if it's not my own monks listening to the nuns, it's nothing wrong with you nuns, this is just what people are like. It's always a pain to listen to people. It's a pain when people sort of ring up. Even these days they send faxes as well, I've got to read those. Just all of these communications, it's just so much suffering. That's why if you don't have to write a letter, stop writing your letters. Stop communicating with other people. It's just suffering. When we understand just what this real suffering is, sometimes eventually you get the message that these senses are inherently suffering. To see is to feel pain. To hear is to hear pain. To smell, even to taste, is to taste pain. And to feel in this body is pain as well. I think one of the doctors actually sent me an article that all this, those sensory things on the end of your fingers, and the nerves, that's the nervous system, that's the word I was looking for, the nervous system, which registers pain and pleasure in your brain, it's the same stimulus. It's just we interpret it as pleasure or we interpret it as pain. But there's no essential difference between the stimuli, which sometimes we say is pleasure and sometimes we say is pain. Basically, the neuroscientists can't distinguish between those two things. It's just people say one is pleasure, one is pain. When you understand that, you understand that this is all irritation of the sensory system. The longer you live, the more mindful and the smarter you are, the more you actually see that the suffering is not just not getting what you want or having frustrated expectations. It's also just the sensory experience is inherently suffering and painful. That degree of insight is what will motivate you to let go of sensory experience. If you still think that sensory experience is fun, you'll never be able to let go enough to get into the deep meditations. That's why in that sutta we chant at the end of the Patimokkha, the Tayana Gata, Napahaya Muni Kame Nekatamu Papajati. If you haven't abandoned these five senses, you will never be able to gain this oneness of mind, this singleness of the deep meditations. And how can you abandon that attachment to the five senses? Is to see through them, to see what they really are. Obviously, as you've heard me teach before, once you get into the jhana, it becomes quite obvious that that's the truth. But you also need a little bit of insight into the suffering of the sensory world to be able to motivate yourself to let them go in the first place and develop the deep meditations. Otherwise, you'd be sitting meditation and you'd be dreaming and fantasizing about some perfect world, dreaming about a nice monastery, or about food, or about girls or boys, if nuns are here today, I don't know what you dream and fantasize about, why you waste your time. Why do people do this? Because they feel there's going to be some happiness there. But whenever there is a thought that this is going to be happiness, there comes from that craving. Craving comes from the delusion that there's happiness here, and therefore you want it. Whether it's craving because it's somebody's birthday and you're going to get toast tomorrow morning, or it's craving because your father has invited you to home for a dana and you can have your favorite food. I remember for years craving for fish and chips. For years craving for that as a monk in Thailand. And then I first got my first bit of suffering when I went to visit my mother, first time after 7 years. And I thought, wow, I can get mother's cooking at last after 7 years of, you know, sticky rice and frogs and all that disgusting food I put in my mouth in the early days. And as soon as I walked into her flat, I couldn't believe this. Mama was playing games with me, for sure. She had the pan in which she would fry chips. And the tradition was that that pan would never be washed or scrubbed, otherwise it took the flavor away. And as soon as I came into the house, she looked at that, and I recognized that was the pan in which she had been frying chips, you know, for about 10 or 15 years. I remembered it, and I've just come back to visit her after 7 years in Thailand. And as soon as I walked in, she said, you know, I've been thinking of throwing that away. And she threw it away right in front of me and put it in the bin. And I couldn't say anything. I was just stunned, shocked, in deep suffering. It was a stupid thing. But then finally, you know, that trip, the first time I went to England after 7 years in Thailand, I did get chips only once, and that was from a Thai man. Everyone else thought, oh, you like rice. And they fed me rice every day. So much for going home. But anyway, I remember coming here to Australia and having to go to a funeral in the morning. And on the way back, Ajahn Chacko said, oh, just get yourself something to eat on the way back. Great, I had chance for fish and chips, real fish and chips the first time. And it was just such a disappointment. When actually you got it, it never lived up to your expectations at all. There's another thing I could tick off as not being happy. Another thing which was dukkha in this world. If you look deeply and just, you know, you see things as they truly are, it's just an irritation of the senses to eat. It's an irritation to read, to listen. And if you realize that, then you may have an opportunity of turning away from the sensory world. And you know those people who turn away from the sensory world because they turn away from speech. They turn away from sights. They turn away from comfortable feelings because they realize there's no happiness to be found there. They don't look at the pretty girls who come into the monastery. There's nothing, no happiness to be found there. It's just an irritation, a stirring up. And they don't sort of worry about, you know, looking at the pretty pictures or listening to the music. Just more irritation. Instead, once they realize that all this stuff is just a bundle of suffering, sabbe sankhara dukkha, then we can have the motivation to let it go, to not be interested in it. So instead we walk away from conversations. We try and end them. We walk away from sights. So we don't go sitting on the hillside watching the sun go down. We sit in the darkness of our hut, watching the breath go in and out instead. Something more simple and more serene. We don't go even listening to so many Dhamma talks. How many Dhamma talks do you really need to become enlightened? Instead, we just listen to silence. We don't go around just massaging our bodies. We sit quietly, still, and allow the body to disappear. And when we do close our eyes, we don't go into what the Buddha called karma vitaka, the thoughts about that sensory world. We don't go around thinking of fantasies or dreams or plans. Because even the thoughts about that sensory world are just thoughts about suffering, that's all. If you can really see that, at least have faith in it, it means you turn away from the world and you seek solitude. You seek places where there's very little sensory stimulus and you tend to lessen the sensory stimulus in your life. Using the phone less, writing less, listening less, seeing less. And if you can do that, you find that you go inside instead of going outside. When you realize this outside world of the five senses promises you very much, but always never meets its promises. always disappoints. It can be good, but not quite good enough. And it always leaves you empty, wanting more afterwards. After a while, you never follow that outside path, you follow the inner path instead. That degree of motivation to see the suffering in the sensory world, to see that seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching is dukkha, and thinking about hearing, thinking about seeing, thinking about smelling, thinking about tasting, thinking about physical feelings is also suffering. Investigate that. That's what the Buddha said. That's what I say. That's what you should see. If you can contemplate that and get it very deeply inside of you, you'll find that there's less to take you away from the serenity of your mind. Whether you're walking or whether you're sitting, you'll tend to go inwards rather than outwards. You're using the Dhamma of the Buddha to be able to motivate you to go inwards rather than outwards. These teachings tranquilize you, they calm you, they take you inside. So that when you are meditating, when you are, say, watching the breath, why would a thought grab you and take you away? It's usually just thoughts of suffering, thoughts of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. So you let those things go. How do you let them grow? Go? Because you see them for what they truly are, as suffering. Usually they say, from samadhi you see things as they truly are. When you see them fully through samadhi, but even if you haven't got the samadhi, you have enough experience, enough wisdom, to understand enough about suffering, and to understand that these are suffering, to be able to let them go. Just reflect on your life. To reflect on everything which you know as happiness. And then ask, is that really truly happy? Be honest about it. If you're truly honest about it, yeah, it seems happy at the time, but there's the disadvantage on it. It's never good enough, and it always leaves you wanting something more afterwards. It's never fulfilling. It's like half happiness, and half happiness is not good enough. If you look very deeply and carefully, you should be able to see your own insight and wisdom, that it is suffering, just as the Buddha said. Remember that when you meditate, and that will really motivate you and help you just to go deeply inside. Even like having a monastery, making it all perfect before the rains retreat. It's never perfect, there's always something wrong. Something still needs to be done. Just drop it, it's good enough. So we can leave all the externals aside. We don't have to worry about monastery, it's just all sights, sounds, smells, tastes and touches. Buddhist Society of Western Australia is just all sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches. Committee meetings, just all sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches. Retreat centres, it's all sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches. All your friends and relations, just sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches. It's just all 5 cents stuff. So drop it. It's just suffering. You've got this opportunity now. You're allowed to do that. Many few places you're permitted to leave the world. In monasteries you are allowed. So you just go in your hut. You can put aside the books. Put aside all the studies. Put aside all the projects. Put aside all the letters. You just sit. And motivate yourself by saying, sights are suffering, sound is suffering, smells, taste is suffering, physical sensations are suffering. So have nibbida towards them. Nibbida is just repulsion, just not interested anymore. Yuck, why would I want to worry about that? And that degree of repulsion to the five sense world will make it quite easy for you just to watch the breath. It's like an escape. That's why the Buddha said you should meditate like your hair is on fire. What does that mean? It means you meditate knowing these five senses are painful. But you got an opportunity of getting out. And this is what one does. Ask yourself, for those of you who have had a peaceful meditation, isn't that just the place of least suffering? Out in the world, it's just hard and difficult and disappointing and frustrating. But in your meditation, isn't that the place where there's a sense of peace and freedom? The place of least suffering? Certainly in my life, my meditation as a layperson was the place, the abode of least suffering in my life. Even though I was young, successful, good at my studies, had girlfriends, reasonably well off. But still my meditation was far better than anything. It was a place of least suffering, least pain. Isn't that the case with each one of you? You may not be great meditators, but each one of you, your meditation is good enough to know this. If that's a place of least suffering, why don't you go back there more often? As we go back there more often, we're motivated by the abandoning of suffering to sit, to walk, not thinking, not looking around, not trying to get more sensory impressions, but to let go of these sensory impressions, to move away from them, to move inwards to the mind. With that degree of motivation, you find your meditation takes off. You watch the breath, sounds, thoughts come up, I'm not interested, that's just suffering. Why am I going to catch on to things which are suffering? Motivating that way stops the craving of the sense sphere. Remember what I said earlier, craving comes from delusion. The delusion that what you crave for is happiness. If you really not realize the object of your craving is just a bunch of shit, you never grab onto it. You never look for it. You never try and move towards it. Instead, you'd move away. In the same way you'd move away from a snake or from a fire. This is how we motivate ourselves to move towards the Dhamma of release from suffering. So when you are meditating, don't just sit there and just meditate. Motivate yourself. Why are you meditating? What's the whole purpose of this? It's to escape from suffering. To go to the place of least suffering, and then a place of even less suffering, and the place of even less suffering. As you go in the realm of the mind. And you will find, this is what the Buddha said, this is what the teachers say, certainly what I say, you will find when you really do get into some deep meditations, you feel that you're getting somewhere. This is Buddhism, this is Dhamma. It's a simple Dhamma. You don't have to be a university graduate or to have a great education to understand this, because you feel it for yourself. This is peace, this is freedom, this is happiness. And as you get into those deep meditation states, you realize what they are and why they are, it gets even more clear to you that all this seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching really is suffering. The Buddha was right. You just saw it superficially, but now you're seeing it deeper and deeper and deeper. You wonder, why on earth do I want to do all this stuff? Only if you have to is your duty. But you keep it to the absolute minimum when you have got a chance. You just get back into your hut, for me in my cave, and you just sit there. That's why I have a cave. That's why I love that cave. Because it shuts out all the sounds, all the sights, smells, tastes, and many of the touches. I don't like windows. The same way I don't like the windows on the front of my face, on either side of my nose. Which make me see. That's why I like to close them. I don't want to look out. You know, that's one person said why that many monks used to live in forests and they get enlightened in forests. Not so much on mountains, but in forests. Because in forests you can't see far. You just see the trees in front of you. You don't see great distances, and one tree looks like the next. Sometimes I wonder if a person could get enlightened living on top of a mountain with beautiful views. Sometimes people said, why were all these great teachers in Thailand born in the Northeast? Because the Northeast is the most unspectacular plain, very few hills and mountains, and because of the poor soil, there's nothing very beautiful to see. Other than along the Mekong River, there's no tourists usually go to the Northeast. There's nothing to see there. It's just most uninspiring for tourists, which is why you get great meditation teachers there. There's nothing to look at. So by living in a forest or by living in a cave, there's nothing to look at. So because there's nothing to look at, you close your eyes and you look in, because there's nothing to hear. You just look in, because there's nothing to smell or taste. We don't have anything to eat in the evenings. There's nothing to do, except to go in. And when you try and do that, when you do these things, you find that quite naturally the mind just goes deeper in and it realizes, yes, that's true, the suffering is those five senses. And when those when that mind completely lets go of the five senses, that's called the jhanas. These deep states of mind, when you're blissed out, having great fun, you just got the mind there, you can't feel your body or hear any sounds. It's a beautiful state to be in. And I can't see why more monks and nuns don't enjoy those states. States where you can't feel the body anymore, you can't hear any sounds. You're deep inside of yourself, like in the cave, but the cave which the Buddha called the cave of the heart. I think it's called Hadaya Guha. As you go into that cave of the heart, not only are you blissing out, you're motivated by understanding that five sense world is suffering, so you go inside, and your insights are confirmed. When you come out of these deep states of meditation, you always ask, why was that so much happiness? The place of least suffering, the place where I've had the best experience. You ask why, and it's obvious what the answer is. Even the most beautiful sights are just shit compared to being in a jhana. Now, some lay people, they say, just seeing sort of the birth of my first child was just the most amazing experience. Oh, come on, that's nothing compared to when you're not seeing anything at all. Or they say just hearing Beethoven's Fifth played by the Berlin Philharmonic. That's nothing compared to the silence, the deep silence. Or sort of going to the best restaurant, which is usually your mother's kitchen. That's nothing compared just to when you're not tasting anything at all. And even sex, the best sex, is nothing compared to just when the body is not irritating you at all, and it's not demanding any more attention, and it's just gone. People are experiencing those deep meditations. It changes the whole way they look at life. You know, just keep on going back to my own personal story, getting into deep meditation when I was a student, having sex with my girlfriend at the time, and just couldn't believe it. It was much, much better than with my girlfriend. And that really sort of blew me away. How can that be? You know, because it was such a surprising experience and so powerful, you did start contemplating it. Why in that state? And I noticed in that state I couldn't feel my body, couldn't hear any sounds. It was gone. Why was that so wonderful? Eventually it dawns on you, especially when you repeat those experiences again and again. Why? It's because seeing is suffering. Any type of seeing the most beautiful thing, the best sound, the best physical experiences, whatever, even drugs, heroin. I've never taken heroin, but whatever it is, it's nothing compared to when those things have disappeared. Now what does that mean? That means that those things are suffering. When you let them go, it's happiness. You're letting go of your attachment and craving to sensory things. You're letting go of these things because all you're doing is letting go of suffering. When you realize it's suffering, when you realize it's painful, you will never crave for it. No more than if we put out some feces on the table for lunch, not one of you will take it and put it in your bowl. You won't have any craving for that at all. I'm pretty sure of that. Maybe a few weirdos in this monastery, I don't know. But most of you will just leave it alone. Now I understand, if you could look at, say, sex, like a lump of shit, none of you would fantasize about it, would you? When you're thinking about what you're going to have for breakfast tomorrow morning, you know, if it was shit for breakfast, would you sort of, you know, rush down early in the morning just to get a bit extra, like some people do with a toast? Of course not. So it's only because we think these things are happiness and pleasure and good, that's the only reason we crave for them. So to end craving, you can't end craving with other craving. You only end craving through wisdom, through seeing through things, through understanding the nature of things, for seeing things as they truly are. When you see all these things, they're just fire, they're just hurt, it's like grabbing onto a snake, it's going to bite you. So you keep away from snakes. You keep away from crocodiles, from whirlpools and waves. You know what those four are. You can look in the books if you don't know. But these are things which you move away from because you realize there's only pain there. And when you move away from those things, there's only one place you can go. And that's deep in meditation, in the mind. That's why when people become wise, when they become smart, when they see suffering, that's why they move into meditation. So if you're not meditating, or you find, you know, you're just still caught in this world, you keep thinking and you keep doing things, it means you haven't seen the Four Noble Truths yet. You haven't seen suffering. You've seen some suffering, yes, enough suffering to come into this monastery, but not enough to come into the monastery totally. Half of you is in the monastery, but half of you is still in the world, thinking fantasies, dreams and hopes. If you've really seen through those, then you can be said you're fully in this monastery. You've left the world. You've gone, can gain access into the deep meditations. That's why it says that the anagami, the non-returner, they have no problem getting into jhanas. Why? It's because they've seen that all sights, sounds, smells, tastes and touches are suffering. They've seen it completely, totally. So they, no way would they go putting their hand in the fire. They just move away. And because they move away, there's only one place they go, into just the sixth sense, into the mind, into the jhanas. True. They've still got one more thing to let go of in their mind. But as most those teachers say, that's the easy one to let go of. It's the other stuff which is a hard one to let go of, just the five senses. And if you become anagamis by the end of this range retreat, well, you'll be a happy monk, a happy novice, a happy nun, a happy layperson, and certainly I'll be a happy teacher. I'll be very proud of you. If you're all anagamis by the end of this retreat, wouldn't that be a wonderful thing? So now I'll tell you how to do it. And it's, don't become an anagami just because you think and you got some great insight. You know you're an anagami, a non-returner, if there's nothing between you and those jhanas. You can just go in and out whenever you want. So that's why I say that these are attainments, if you like, which are measured by your ability to be peaceful, to be calm, to be still. If you can't be still, it means you haven't got insights yet. The insights aren't full enough. But if your mind can be absolutely still, so still that the external world vanishes and disappears, then you know that you haven't got craving for that outside world anymore. Why haven't you got craving? Because you're seeing it suffering. And who can crave for suffering. It just, you can't do it. It's an impossibility to want what you know is pain. Even the masochists, they take pain to be pleasure, that's why they want that. But if you really know it as pain and suffering, no way would you want it. Just using a simile of the piece of feces on the table at lunchtime, simile. So this is how we can improve our meditation. This is how we can gain more seclusion. This is how we can be monks, by learning how to recognize the suffering of the five senses. Seeing it more deeply, more fully, even without the jhanas, to see it before, enough to be able to let go, to get into deep meditations, and get that confirmed after you gain those deep meditations. Check what the suttas say. Check what the great teachers say. This is one point we all agree on. The five senses are suffering. Why is it you get attached to these things? Why is it you get attached to food? Why do you crave these things? Ask yourself. It's only because you think they're going to be happy. Question that. Challenge it. Challenge it until you see through these delusions. And when you see through these delusions, your meditation will take off. So the talk today was on seeing the suffering of the five senses, so it empower your meditation. So you only have one place to resort to, one refuge, deep in the mind, and you won't take refuge in the world ever again. That's the talk this evening.
Sati Pano Bhagavan.